It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station from Kodiak, Alaska, where we are seeing overcast skies. It is 43 degrees, and out at the airport, they are registering 93% humidity, as well as 10 miles of visibility. They also show easterly winds to 14 miles per hour, which is exactly what the Weather Service is predicting, as well as a 50% chance of rain today, mostly cloudy skies. Coming up on the Midday Report, a closer look at the local results from last week's election. State health officials are urging Alaskans to get the flu jab. And the tallest building in the city of Fairbanks is also the ugliest. They are getting closer to actually demolishing it. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Nancy Pelosi, the first and only woman ever to serve as Speaker of the House, is retiring from her Democratic Party leadership role, but staying in Congress. The Republicans will regain control of the House starting January following wins in the midterm elections. On the floor of the House today, Pelosi called on colleagues to defend a fragile democracy. Her remarks evoking memories of the January 6th insurrection in the Capitol last year. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports Pelosi's departure from the leadership post now opens the door to a younger generation of party leaders.
Nancy Pelosi received a standing ovation after delivering a heartfelt speech on the House floor. In her remarks, the speaker reflected on her historic tenure and then said it was time to step aside.
For me, the hours come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect. And I'm grateful that so many are ready and willing to shoulder this awesome responsibility.
New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries has emerged as the frontrunner to succeed her. He has the support of another prominent House Democrat, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, who also announced today that he plans to step aside. House Democrats will hold a leadership meeting later this month. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The tax fraud trial of former President Donald Trump's family business resumed today in New York. NPR's Ilya Meritz reports a star witness was questioned both by prosecutors and defense attorneys.
Former CFO Alan Weisselberg has been a steady presence in the executive suite in Trump Tower since the mid-1980s. In August, he pleaded guilty to 15 felonies, mostly financial crimes. On cross-examination, he admitted he betrayed the Trump family for personal gain. His voice broke as he described his embarrassment. Earlier, under direct examination, Weisselberg said these tax dodges benefited not just him, but also the Trump business. He said that the company took steps to clean up its act in 2017 when Donald Trump became president. Ilya Meritz, NPR News, New York.
The Russian government has agreed to an extension of a Black Sea Agreement deal that would allow grain to continue flowing to countries facing some of the worst food shortages on the planet. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it seems Russia felt the world would not have accepted it if Moscow had turned its back on the agreement.
What we're seeing is a very telling split screen. As the world works to help the most vulnerable people, Russia targets them. As leaders worldwide reaffirm their commitment to the UN Charter and international rules that benefit all our people, President Putin continues to try to shred those same principles.
Blinken speaking ahead of an APEC summit in Bangkok about Russia's ongoing missile attacks on Ukrainian civilians and their infrastructure as winter approaches. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Voters won't know the results from last week's statewide election until next week, but there are already some indications about who voters in Kodiak's legislative district ranked first on their ballots. Here is KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth.
According to unofficial results from Alaska's Division of Elections, nearly half of voters in Kodiak's district voted for current Governor Mike Dunleavy. Dunleavy holds a lead of over 50% in the statewide results, too. Former Governor Bill Walker and Democrat Les Guerra are currently second and third, respectively, in the unofficial results, with 28% and 19% of the vote. And in the race for U.S. Senate, just over 50% of Kodiak voters ranked incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski first on their ballots. About a third voted for Murkowski's Republican challenger, Kelly Chewbacca. That's a tighter race statewide, as vote totals released by the state's Division of Elections on Tuesday have the candidates neck and neck. 9% of voters in Kodiak's district ranked Democrat Pat Chesbrough first. About half of voters in Kodiak's district also ranked incumbent U.S. House Representative Mary Peltola first on their ballots, although within the city of Kodiak, more votes were cast for former Governor Sarah Palin. Palin was ranked first by 30% of voters. Nick Begich is third in that race. That mirrors current statewide results, too. And according to the latest Division of Elections numbers, incumbent State Representative Louise Stutes and State Senator Gary Stevens are still leading in their races. Both candidates had received more than 50% of the vote as of numbers released on election night. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
State health officials are urging Alaskans to get flu vaccines and take other protective measures as case counts increase rapidly across the country. States in the southern half of the lower 48 have the most flu cases right now. But in a public health presentation on Wednesday, state epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin said the wave is expected to reach Alaska in the coming weeks.
We're seeing very high rates of increase of influenza-like activity in the nation, and it's occurring much earlier than it has in recent years.
Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is also spreading. McLaughlin says elderly people and young children, especially premature babies and those with chronic respiratory illnesses, are particularly vulnerable.
Most people who get an RSV infection will have mild illness and will recover within 1 to 2 weeks, but some people do get very sick and require hospitalization.
There's no vaccine for RSV, but a monoclonal antibody treatment is available for at-risk patients. Both RSV and the flu are already straining regional hospital systems. Flu-related hospitalizations among children are currently at levels not usually seen until late December and early January, according to data from the CDC. Gene Wiseman is the Division of Public Health's Section Chief for Rural and Community Health Systems. He says staff shortages and the early rise in RSV and flu cases are already impacting hospitals' ability to transfer patients out of state.
Region 9 and Region 10, which are our neighboring states, Region 10 being Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, are all at capacity as well in their hospitals. So that although they're a normal pop-off valve for some of our sicker patients here, we're finding that we're needing to hold patients in Alaska.
Health officials say having less capacity in children's hospitals would impact the availability of emergency medical treatment like injuries, for example. The state's clinical pharmacologist, Coleman Cutchins, says the situation mirrors COVID.
You know, with COVID, we really worried about adults. You know, fortunately, it didn't hit kids all that hard. So we worried about, you know, adult hospitals being overwhelmed, adult ICUs. But now when we're talking about RSV and flu, you know, yeah, they affect adults, but it's a lot more worried about kids.
Health officials stress the importance of getting kids vaccinated against the flu and COVID. The city of Fairbanks is getting closer to demolishing its tallest building and biggest downtown eyesore, the abandoned 11-story Polaris Hotel. Local officials and business owners gathered on Tuesday to hear an update on the Long in the Works project, which is scheduled to get underway in the new year. KUAC's Dan Bross has this report.
The city of Fairbanks is awaiting receipt of a $10 million earmark from the Environmental Protection Agency secured for the Polaris demolition by Senator Lisa Murkowski. City engineer Bob Pristash outlined a series of steps required to access the money, including a work plan.
A strategy. How are you going to take the building down?
Pristash said the city is proposing a two-step approach, starting this winter with demolition of an addition on the Polaris building's south side, known as the Annex.
Take the Annex down first, and then the tower later.
Pristash highlighted that the dangerously deteriorated condition of the Polaris has accelerated the EPA's regulatory process.
I gave them the work plan, and they approved it September 28th. And now on their website, November 7th, is a completed environmental document, which was an environmental assessment. And they also posted what they call a finding of no significant impact to FONSI. I mean, that's almost unheard of, to have an environmental assessment done in this short a period of time and open the gates for the money to the city.
Built in 1952, the Polaris is an historic structure, and the demolition of it requires the city to work with the State Historic Preservation Office to recognize and document the building.
Basically, we're suggesting a plaque and photos taken of the building according to their requirements.
Meanwhile, Pristash anticipates that the cost of demolishing the Polaris will be higher than originally estimated due to the discovery of PCBs and paint on the concrete structure, which will require the material to be shipped to the lower 48 for disposal.
We're thinking $14 million, but we don't know for sure because we don't know what the cost of shipping that concrete out is going to be.
City Mayor David Prus, who's been involved in the effort to bring down the Polaris from the start, said work is already underway to find funding to cover the additional cost.
You know, every time we go that step forward, it's a half step back. But we keep going forward. We keep pressing it.
Mayor Prus pledged to inform and consult with owners of surrounding buildings and businesses throughout the demolition planning process.
We are ground zero, I guess you could say.
Arlette Eagle Lavelle operates Lavelle's Tap House next door to the Polaris building. Lavelle says removal of the Polaris will ultimately be good for her business, and Tuesday's meeting eased concerns about impacts during the demolition.
I believe if what they said at this meeting, as far as keeping us open, clear communication with access to any reports and or bids that are going out to the contractors is true and correct, then there should be no problems.
While demolition of the Polaris Annex is targeted for this winter, the timeline for the subsequent much larger main hotel tower removal project has yet to be finalized. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Anchorage police officials say they're finalizing a policy for officers to begin carrying the opioid-reversing drug naloxone, commonly known by the brand name Narcan. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the decision follows growing demands from residents who want to curb the rising number of overdoses in Alaska.
The plan for Anchorage police to start carrying Narcan was not announced to the public, but in an email Wednesday, APD spokeswoman Renee Oystad confirmed that the department hopes to implement the policy by early next year. Oystad wrote, quote, "The policy is being edited and finalized. Once that has occurred, officers will be trained on both the policy and the application of Narcan," unquote. It's welcome news for advocates like Sandy Snodgrass, who've long pushed for the use of Narcan by the city's police force.
I'm glad, really pleased, that they will have another tool to serve the public with having naloxone available.
Snodgrass's son, Bruce, died from a fentanyl overdose last October. Across Alaska, opioid-related deaths have skyrocketed in recent years, with state data showing a 70% increase in those deaths from 2020 to 2021. About three-quarters of the deaths involve the synthetic opioid fentanyl. Narcan, which often comes as a nasal spray, can quickly reverse an opioid overdose, and many advocates tout it as a tool to help fight the sharp rise in those deaths. But the Anchorage Police Department has been slow in adopting Narcan. It's among the last major law enforcement agencies in Alaska that doesn't have officers carrying the reversal drug. Alaska State Troopers, the Wasilla Police Department, and Village Public Safety Officers are among agencies that have already trained their officers to use it. Snodgrass held a rally in August in front of the Anchorage Police Headquarters to push for officers to carry Narcan, even handing out kits to officers as they walked in and out of the building. She said use of the reversal drug will not only be beneficial to the public, but to officers as well.
There have been incidents in the country where police officers have been poisoned by fentanyl and needed to be revived by their fellow officers on the scene. And so I'm glad that Anchorage police officers will be safer.
Snodgrass said while she's grateful for the impending Narcan policy, she's also frustrated it has taken so long. A day after Snodgrass's August rally, Anchorage Police Chief Michael Curl had expressed interest in revising the department's longstanding policy, which had fire department medics carrying Narcan instead of police officers. In an email, Oystad, the APD spokeswoman, said the medical advisor with the fire department, whom the police are also coordinating with, had, quote, changed his opinion on whether officers should carry Narcan. She says the Anchorage Police Union also gave input to help shape the proposed Narcan policy. Union President Jeremy Conkling says he welcomes the policy.
You know, any tools that our officers can get that'll help us better serve the citizens of Anchorage, we certainly support that. And, you know, if this saves one life, it's worth it, right?
Conkling says he hasn't heard any pushback from officers about the impending change. Anchorage police officials declined an interview request Wednesday on the policy specifics and timelines, saying the policy has not been finalized yet. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A totem pole that spent more than 100 years far from home has returned to the Haida village of Kasan on Prince of Wales Island. It's the first time any clan property has been repatriated to the village of about 30 residents. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
We are really small, but we're still here.
The Yadis pole is massive. It's too old to stand now, having been carved in the late 1800s, but when it did, it stood 52 feet tall and 4 feet wide. It even has a steel core and had to be barged up on a flatbed truck because it was too big for a box. Mike Jones is the president of Kasan's tribe. He says the village turned out on a recent Saturday to see the first piece of clan property to come back to Kasan.
I feel like the pole's been displaced for a long time and been wanting to come home and had to have some kind of recognition.
Jones says it's a symbol of pride for the people of Kasan, a Haida village on the eastern shore of Prince of Wales Island.
We are the original totem pole people. We're the first of the first. Totem pole carving for us goes back to mythical times. We are the only culture in the entire world to have monumental sculpture in front of every single house. Nobody else did that. None of our neighbors did that. So it really became a symbol of bringing our culture back.
The Yadis pole spent more than 100 years away from the village. Jones says it left with then-Chief Sonahat Wilson Peel, who was taking the pole down to California for the 1906 Indian Crafts Exhibition in Redondo. Jones says he also took a dismantled house and other poles with him.
He actually took 200 tons altogether, including the house, the poles, and other paraphernalia, rattles and masks and things like this that he took down.
The pole was split into two pieces for the journey. After the show, it moved into a private collection. In 1951, the pole was found in a lumberyard, waiting to be made into pulp. The pole was then placed in the courtyard of the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center until 2006, when it became too old to stand up and was put into storage. Then, in 2010, Jones says the idea of bringing it home started to reach Kasan, where, more than 100 years ago, it fronted the house of the chief.
The Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center reached out to the organized village of Kasan in 2010, expressing that they wanted to repatriate the pole. And at that time, we did not have our cafe or the carving shed, and there was some concern as to where to put it. And the main thing was the funding was not available at the time, so it stayed in storage.
But when Jones took his job as tribe president in 2019, it also sparked his desire to dive deeper into his Haida culture, and he started thinking about the pole again. It was then that he got an email from Richard Reinhart, the CEO of the Central Council of Klink and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska's Business Center, who also wanted to make the repatriation happen.
Like, first started going through this reawakening of our culture, and, you know, because we went through what we call the silent years, right, after kind of a, you know, there's been a cultural genocide that through the boarding schools and things like that. So a lot of us, my generation, I'm in my 50s, we didn't grow up, you know, really knowing who we were and our history and our culture and stuff.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute helped pay for the repatriation, along with more help from Klinkit and Haida. Jones says that's an important gesture.
It'll affect the way that I carry myself, because I know that my village is important. And it was shown that we matter. We're such a small tribe here. And Phil Ask really stepped up to help us bring our history back.
It's not just Kassan that's benefiting from the repatriation. Jones says he's heard from Haida people in Haida Gwaii who admire the poll.
And that's the ripple effect of it, that it's touching people from so far away.
Jones says the pole was placed on a site where the tribe hopes to one day build a cultural center. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Insight Daily Radio. Iconic character actor Tom Wopat reprises his role as Sheriff Alden Rockwell in the long-awaited sequel to the action movie County Line, with County Line all in. When a not-so-popular lawyer is killed literally on the county line, Maxville County Sheriff Alden Rockwell must reluctantly work with the newly elected sheriff, Joe Porter, of the neighboring York County. Her big city methods clash with his old-school ways, but when the murderer continues to strike, they must learn to set aside their differences and work together in order to stop the killer. We spoke with Tom and co-star Kelsey Crane about this exciting new film.
In Alden's world, it's like he sees things pretty black and white. If he sees something that has to be done and it might be a little bit illegal, he's probably going to do it.
Yeah. I have to tell you a couple times in this film, like, that's illegal. We're sheriffs, you know? But that's the missing piece that allows us to solve these crimes. And
in the context of these counties that we're talking about, there is a certain Wild West quality to it. And I think that the people that we're dealing with on the other side, the people that are doing the illegal stuff, they recognize that as well. So that lends itself to maybe bending the rules a little bit here or there.
That's Tom Wopat on his role as Sheriff Alden Rockwell with co-star Kelsey Crane in County Line All In. County Line All In premieres on INSP Saturday, November 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern. To find out where to watch in your area, go to countylineallin.com. Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to Thursday. It is the 17th day of November, the year 2022. The sun rose today at exactly 9 a.m. and it will set again at 4:48. That will give us 7 hours and 48 minutes of daylight, a loss of exactly 4 minutes. Our record high for this date was 50 degrees, set in 1990, and our record low was 10 degrees. That was set in 1975. Currently 43 degrees under overcast skies. The fog lifted. They have 10 miles of visibility out at the airport right now, and easterly winds at 14 miles per hour, as well as 93% humidity. The Weather Service is calling for a 50-50 chance of rain this afternoon, mostly cloudy skies. That will continue overnight and through tomorrow. High near 45 today. Low around 41 overnight tonight. East winds to 15 will continue tonight and turn to the northeast tomorrow to 15, gusting as high as 20. Looking at our local tides, we have an outgoing tide. Our next low tide here on the east side will be at 2:51 p.m. and be 4 feet, followed by a high tide at 8:22 this evening of 6.3 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 3:48 this afternoon and be a 6-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at exactly 9 p.m. of 9.9 feet. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side. Small craft advisory through Friday. East winds to 30 knots, seas to 10 feet today. Northeast 25, seas to 9 feet tonight and tomorrow. Tomorrow night, northeast 30, seas to 11 feet. And for Saturday, north 30, seas to 14 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning for today. Northeast 35, seas to 11 feet today. For tonight and tomorrow, northeast 30 seas to 10 feet. And for tomorrow night in the Shelikof, northeast 40 seas to 14 feet. Well, coming up this Friday, it's Scuttlebutt. It's a galley tables event for youth. Show your support and have a great time listening to their young storytellers spin a yarn and entertain the crowd. It's all completely free, no charge for admission. It's happening 7 p.m. this Friday at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Drama Pod. And then the next day, Galley Tables is back. Kodiak's beloved storytelling event returns this Saturday, November 19th. Listen to seven storytellers tell their stories about a theme that's, in this case, home again. That's happening in St. Mary's Gym. Doors open at 7 p.m., and the stories start at 7:30. Also, a local marimba band will be playing, and that's happening between 7 and 7:30. Donations are welcomed. Find out more at galleytables.com. The Kodiak Hospital Auxiliary is having a general meeting on Saturday. That starts at 10 a.m. in the Barometer Room at the Providence Kodiak Island Hospital. Everyone is welcome to attend. The short business meeting will be followed by the decorating of the angel trees. Please plan to attend and help decorate the angel trees throughout the hospital and support the raffle. Raffle tickets will also be available for members to pick up at that time. This is the last general Kodiak Hospital Auxiliary meeting until January. Notice is hereby given. The Board of Education regular meeting will be happening on November 21st, next Monday, at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room. That's F-140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will also be live-streamed through BlueJeans. Meeting information, login information is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District website. Look under the Board of Education tab. If you need more information, contact the Secretary to the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. Elementary school families, please mark your calendars. November 22nd will be an early release day for all Kodiak Island Borough School District elementary schools. Grades kindergarten through 5 will be dismissed at 1:50 p.m. for scheduled family teacher conferences. Please call your school office if you have any questions. Again, that's November 22nd. They'll be let out at 1:50 in the afternoon. Well, Mattson is sponsoring free admission to the Lutic Museum. That's starting November 22nd and running through December 23rd, the entire month. Thank you, Mattson. Free Lutic Museum admission starting November 22nd. Coming up on December 3rd, it's the Chiniac Christmas Market. They'll be offering arts, crafts, pottery, salves, preserves, baked goods, and more, all handmade in Kodiak. It's happening at the Chiniac Library from noon to 4 p.m. December 3rd. That's a Saturday. To get there, just take a right on King Crab Way. At mile 41 and a quarter, the road curves to the right, and the library is located on the left-hand side. Going on all month with the Girl Scouts of America, it's STEMAPALOOZA. Celebrate science, technology, engineering, and math with STEMAPALOOZA all month on the month of November. All girls in grades K through 12 are invited to explore this month-long event. Visit Girl Scouts of Alaska's website to find details about live virtual programs, at-home activities, competing with your family in STEM trivia, earning a telescope, becoming a citizen scientist, and learning what it takes to put your STEM dreams into action. Try at least one activity to earn your STEMAPALOOZA patch, or dive in and try them all. And coming up in the latest in the series of workshops held at the Kodiak College, November 16th and 30th, the chemistry of cold process soap making. Soap making is part craft and part science. The foundation of soap making starts with understanding its chemistry. In this two-day workshop, you will learn the materials, skills, and chemistry to craft a basic soap recipe. You will finish up the session by making your first bar of soap. In the second session, you will evaluate the purity of your soap. All materials needed to craft your soap will be provided. And the next one starts on the 16th, November 16th. That's a Wednesday, 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. And just go to the Kodiak College website to find out more details.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.